Unmasking Our Leaders, Confessions of a Political Documentary Maker is the new book by Michael Cockerell. Our political leaders spend their careers spinning their images and polishing their achievements. But Michael has spent his professional life stripping off that gloss over 50 years with unrivaled access to the secret chambers of Westminster and the corridors of Whitehall. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from London, Michael Cockerell himself. Michael, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles.
Good to have you with us. It's a unique claim to fame that you've filmed all of the past 10 prime ministers. And if that's not a broad church, I don't know what isn't.
Yeah, 10 prime ministers I've filmed and interviewed, made films about, going back right the way to Harold Wilson.
So tell me a little bit about then how you got to the position where you were allowed access to the corridors and the chambers of Westminster and Whitehall.
That's a good story. I suppose it all goes back to 1959, on my first day at Oxford, the Freshers' Fair, and it happened to be the day of the 1959 general election when the old Etonian, Balliol-educated Harold Macmillan was Prime Minister. In the same way as all those years later, the Prime Minister is an old Etonian, Balliol-educated classic scholar called Boris Johnson. See how things have changed. And I remember being at the Freshers' Fair where all the societies want to get you to join, and there were the conservatives, the young conservatives, all with floppy blonde hair and with a blackboard where they were chalking up the gains as the majority went over 100. And then there was the Labour Party just looking sad, and they'd got their first meeting of the term was Labour psychologically happier in opposition. I thought, this is fascinating. And that next week, Macmillan himself came to speak to the Oxford Union, and he talked about the First World War, where he was in the Battle of the Somme and severely wounded in the Battle of the Somme. And of his class, classical class, at Balliol, by the end of the war, 19 out of 20 of them had been killed, and he was just so moving, and I thought, this is an amazing man. I need to know something about him and understand the way politics works. Now, little did I know at that stage that 10 years later I would be married to his granddaughter, but mustn't read anything of my politics into all this, because I'm just as fascinated by the Labour and Liberal parties over the years.
Interesting, because we now live in a world where everything is, you could argue, is slick and stage managed. How did your first Prime Minister react to being filmed, being documented by presumably almost newfangled technology back then?
Well, if you go back a little bit before that, I made a film about exactly what you're asking about, how they reacted to television in the very, very early days. And if you think of television in Britain, it didn't start till 1936. It stopped during the war, and then when Churchill came back after the war in 1951, as Prime Minister, both he and the former Labour Prime Minister, Clement Attlee, thought that television was the idiot's lantern, as it was called. Churchill said it's a tuppenny halfpenny Punch and Judy show. And both of them thought that television would have no part to play in the coverage of politics in the future. But then came the coronation, and the Queen wanted her coronation to be televised, which Churchill was against, but she won that battle. And overnight, the sales of TVs doubled, and I remember most people didn't have television sets, and on the day of the coronation, one crowded into the houses of other people to watch the coronation. People crowded into our house because we did have a television. And Churchill saw this and thought, this is a way to be able to speak directly to millions of people at the same time, what politicians have wanted forever. And he arranged to have a secret screen test made. And when we were making this film about television and prime ministers, we discovered that he'd had this secret screen test made, and we went to see the woman producer who'd made it, and she said to us, she was in hospital, she said, "Under my bed, you seem a rather nice young man. And if you go to my house, I'll give you the key for it. Under my bed, there is a big can of film, and it's Churchill's screen test." I couldn't believe it. And we put it on, and there was this extraordinary sight of Churchill saying, "I'm sorry to have to descend to this level, but we all have to keep pace with modern inventions, and it's just..." I'm sorry to... Sorry, let me try and remember exactly what he said. Well, it's very good. But it's just as well to know what this thing they call TV amounts to. And he said this thing they call TV made it sound like a kind of sexually transmitted disease. There was such a distaste there. But when he saw himself on television, he ordered the tape destroyed, but luckily the woman producer knew it was history and kept it under her bed for 30 years until she let us have it. That was so amazing. So for a long time they thought television was beneath them, but the first prime minister who really started it was Macmillan himself. He was canny enough to know what would go on, what was going on with television. At first he thought, when he saw himself in television, he looked like a prisoner behind bars and terrified. But he learned to do it, and he became rather good at it, and was parodied by the cartoonists as Super Mac. And then came Harold Wilson, Labour's Harold Wilson, who won the 1964 election, who saw himself as the British John F. Kennedy, he was the first prime minister to have been born in the 20th century, and he sent for video copies of JFK's press conferences, and he modelled himself on JFK and talked about 100 days of dynamic action and a new Britain, exactly as JFK had taught in America.
I mean, it really was. I mean, Wilson embraced television, didn't he? And it was all part of the whole, as Macmillan may have said, you never had it so good at the beginning of the 60s. But Wilson, if you like, underlined that, at least during the mid-60s, and you think about the explosion there was in Britain of culture, etc. And in pretty much the ways that the old...
Beatles and all that kind of thing. And Wilson himself, who had a Merseyside constituency, sort of identified... himself as the fifth Beatle, and invited the Beatles to number 10, and gave them MBEs.
Interestingly enough, though, I mean, you were making documentaries during the 60s when, quote-unquote, you never had it so good. Were the prime ministers of the 70s, perhaps, more willing to invite you in? Because obviously, from the policy of the 60s, we went to the hangover of the 70s, and people like Wilson, people like Heath, Callaghan, had some pretty, major problems to contend with. Oil strikes, oil shortages... labour shortages, etc.
3-day week, petrol shortages, queues at the petrol station, all that kind of minor strikes. Well, interesting, Wilson was good at television, liked coming on television, liked to be asked, wanted almost to use television like Franklin Delano Roosevelt for fireside chats every 2 weeks, but BBC said he couldn't do that, and he got rather hacked off about that. Oddly enough, he was up against Ted Heath, who was chosen because it was thought he was would be a match for Wilson on television. But actually, Heath was not happy on television, felt uncomfortable on television, and didn't come over well on television. I remember the great interviewer, Sir Robin Day, once asked, I thought one of the best, have you stopped beating your wife questions, if you're allowed to use that phrase these days.
Right.
To Ted Heath, when Ted Heath was in one of the nadirs of his time as a Tory leader. And Robin Day said to Ted Heath, Mr. Heath, how low does your popularity have to sink among your own supporters before you consider yourself a liability to the party you lead? It's a wonderful question that there isn't a yes or no answer to.
Well, indeed. I mean, he could have done a knot, couldn't he, and just have stormed off at that point. But I think he managed to stay with it.
It was on Panorama's Live on Panorama. He didn't do that. But he did say, well, popularity isn't everything. And oddly enough, he managed to make that come true in 1970 when he won unexpectedly the 1970 election, being what the polls called much less popular than Harold Wilson, much less personally popular.
What was Callaghan like to document? Because, you know, he seems to be, if you like, almost the forgotten Prime Minister as we look back. We know people think Wilson, people think Thatcher, who we'll come on to in a minute, and Blair. But, you know, yeah. Callaghan seems to have been forgotten in over the past 50 years of or 60 years of political commentary.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's partly a function of how long you become Prime Minister. All the people who one remembers have a much longer tenure than Jim had. Jim Callaghan had, he only had about 3.5 years, whereas most of them have a tenure of about 7 years, and so they're more remembered. Also, he didn't have a particularly distinguished time, which ended, of course, with the winter of discontent and people, the rats in the streets and the rubbish not being collected, and even the cemetery workers on strike said the bodies weren't being buried. It was horrible, especially because Jim Callaghan had built his career as the keeper of the cloth cap, the man who could handle the trade unions, and then it all blew up in his face. He was actually quite good on television. He'd been good on television from the early days. There was an early form of Prime Minister's questions of question time, but like the television programme, which Jim often went on, and he was quite slick and quite good at it. He knew how to do it. He and I sometimes had arguments. I remember at first when I rang him to do an interview when he was Shadow Foreign Secretary, and he wanted. I was working on a late night program, and he said he wouldn't do it, but he would get his deputy to do it instead of himself. And I said, "Well, I think I can get someone else." And so just as it's your right not to accept my invitation, it must be my right to choose who I want to come on the programme, he said.
Yeah. What was it like when Margaret Thatcher swept into power? I mean, and also, what's it like? I mean, have you covered sort of those election evenings? Have you been with politicians as they've won or lost the keys to number 10?
Yeah, I've been with many politicians on the night of the election. I've lived through many long, dark nights of the soul.
Yeah.
I was with Jim Callaghan when he lost, and he said to me, "A sea change is coming in politics, and it'll be Mrs. Thatcher." He'd said that during the campaign. He was very acute about reading the political runes, and I was with Margaret Thatcher in 1974, and I asked if she would ever become leader, and she said, there'll never be a woman leader in my lifetime. and a year later, she had challenged Ted Heath. And I made a film with her, followed her during the 1979 election. And we had a fascinating relationship because her spin doctors had discovered that she was coming over as uncaring and harsh and strident, and she was given elocution speaking lessons to lower her voice. Her voice was seen as too shrill and harsh and off-putting for people, and she was sent to the National Theatre to take her voice down and speak with a much deeper voice. And the voice coach at the National Theatre said to her that she should every day say about 100 times the word "ungakoka," because that would teach her to put her throat to speak from the back of her mouth.
What word was that? Sorry, I didn't quite get that. Was that "ungakoka," or something you just said?
It was a word that was invented. "Ungakoka." Comes from your throat. and when I next interviewed her, she suddenly had this deep and husky voice. And during the election, I said to her, "I've been following you during this election, and there sometimes seem to be two Mrs. Thatchers. There's the one on the platform with the passionate rhetoric, and then there's one on the shop floor or on the high street, endlessly interested in the minutiae of people's lives. How many Mrs. Thatchers are there?" And she leant forward and said, "Oh, three at least." I said, "What's the three?" She said, "There's the intellectual one, there's the intuitive one, and there's the one at home." And she said that in such a kind of flirtatious manner that Robin Day, who was watching the interview go out on the programme, said, "The untold story of the election campaign, Margaret Thatcher is having an affair with Michael Cockerell."
But of course, she may have been flirting with you, but didn't she tear you apart? Didn't she attack you by name in the comments?
Ah. Flash forward to 1982, the Falklands, and we'd been invaded. The Falkland Islands had been invaded by the Argentinians, and Mrs. Thatcher made the extraordinarily brave decision to send a task force to try and snatch back these islands deep, deep in the South Atlantic, 800-mile journey across the sea. And some of her leading advisors were very sceptical about it, but the first Sea Lord said it could be done. And there was a long time for the task force to sail down to the South Atlantic, and a number of her own MPs were private, and even her own cabinet were privately voicing doubts about the possibility of this working. And at the United Nations and other institutions, they will attempt to see if it would be possible to have a compromise with the Argentinians and avoid war. And so I made a panorama film called "Can We Avoid War?" and talked to, made the egregious error of talking to some of her MPs who had doubts. There was a huge fuss when it went out. And in the House of Commons, a Tory woman MP said to Mrs. Thatcher, and I know the words because it's on the wall in my loo, it said, "Will the Prime Minister take time off in the course of her busy day to watch a recording of last night's panorama, which was an odious and subversive travesty in which Michael Cockerell and others, they betrayed the rights of journalists in this country?" And Mrs. Thatcher said, that she agreed, and there were some people who didn't understand their duty to stand up for our boys. That was probably the lowest point in our relationship, because we did get back together again. I remember I interviewed her after she'd been Prime Minister for 10 years in Number 10, and I'd been talking to her deputy, Willie Whitelaw, and I said to him, "How long do you think that Mrs. Thatcher will remain Prime Minister?" And he said, "Well, I think she'll be Prime Minister for a very long time, very long. She's very fit, very strong, very long time." And I said, "But she's not immortal." And he said, "No, not immortal. But perhaps she is." It was a wonderful Willie Whitelaw thing. And the next day I was in the White drawing room in Number 10, and I quoted what Willie Whitelaw, you know, her loyal deputy, had said. And when I mentioned that he said she was not immortal, if you look at the tape now and freeze it on just that phrase, this sudden look comes into her eyes, a sort of blinding revelation or an intimation of mortality. But when I said, and he said, "No, not immortal, but perhaps she is," she the look goes off her and she said, "What a sweet thing of Willie to say, 'No, I am not immortal, and I don't know how long I'll go on, and no one can know that, Mr. Cockerell.'" So we were back.
Tell me a little bit, because we're going to run out of time, unfortunately, but Tony Blair as well, you had revelations with him. He was perhaps, if you like, when he came into power in the 90s, he seemed to be switched on to the demands of media as it then was. He was the king of the soundbite.
Absolutely. He was absolutely the first absolutely modern user of television, and he had his two kind of sidekicks, Alistair Campbell and Peter Mandelson, and they really understood how the media worked. Mandelson himself had worked for ITV, and everything was plotted and planned. And we got, after 6 years of pestering Alistair Campbell and Blair, we got access to film inside Number 10, the famous Downing Street spin machine, mainly because the Tories were making a lot of Labour spin and saying it's all spin, it's all in the air, it's all nothing. And we were able to film how the news management in Number 10 worked, and that was extraordinary, especially when we filmed Blair coming into Alistair Campbell's office, him wearing shirt sleeves, and there was Campbell in his office wearing a suit, and it looked as if Blair was the schoolboy coming into the headmaster's office. And I interviewed, I doorstepped, in other words, interviewed Blair in the office as he was trying to leave, and I asked him about the charge that they spent the whole time spinning how they were going to win the next election. And he said, "Listen," he said, "you've got to be on top of the media, otherwise a lie is halfway around the world before the truth has got its boots on. It's modern media. You've got to be able to, if they're saying something we're not doing, you've got to be able to react immediately." But he said, "The thing I want is to do the best for the country, and that's the only thing I think about all the time. And if people think otherwise, they're wrong." And Alistair Campbell said, "And that's why you've spent the last 7 minutes talking to Michael Cockerell." So he kind of blown his own client out of the water. He was then after Blair came. Gordon Brown, who hates, it often happens that you have a maestro first of the media, and then someone who can't really perform at all, even though ironically Gordon Brown had been a TV reporter himself, but I think he'd forgotten all he'd learned by the time he became Prime Minister.
And, of course, there was the famous microphone as well, which didn't do him any favours in the car. Always make sure that your cordless microphone is off. Michael, I could talk to you for another hour on this, but unfortunately we're about to commit the cardinal sin of crashing the news. It's been a pleasure to speak to you. This book is called Unmasking Our Leaders. It's by Michael Cockerill, who we've been speaking to. Michael, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.